Hey, good morning. Welcome to Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Flanagan. Thanks so much for tuning in. And by the way, if you'd like to join the chat anytime during the next hour, you can do that by giving us a ring at 414-1234 if it's a local call to Tallahassee. Long distance, we got you covered, 800-926-8809. And email us perspectives@wfsu.org. Okay, I admit it. I don't like to think about the sad inevitability of my personal demise any more than anyone else. Okay, life is so much fun, most of the time anyway. I'd like to hang around forever, but that's just not going to happen. And realizing that, there are some things I really need to handle in advance of the fact. Up-to-date will, okay? That kind of goes without saying. But what about the need to clearly communicate what I want to have happen before the big exit takes place? That's just one of the things we're going to be talking about this morning on Perspectives. We'll also get into things like grief management and other topics connected to what a filmmaking buddy of mine calls the final fade to black. That has such a poetic ring to it there. First, we welcome some wonderful folks from Big Bend Hospice. Let's start with the CEO of the organization, Kathy Atkinson, 34 years as a registered nurse with a Bachelor of Science in Nursing and a dozen years of hospice experience, including, what, the past two at Big Bend.
That's correct. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming. Also from Big Bend Hospice, the Director of Supportive Care Services, the Reverend Candace McKibben, 32 years an ordained minister, having labored in the vineyards of a number of churches, including St. Paul's United Methodist Church and East Hill Baptist Church, both in Tallahassee. She's also been on the ethics committees of not only Big Bend Hospice, but also Tallahassee Memorial and Capital Regional Medical Center. Reverend, good to have you.
Thank you.
And we also have a professor from Florida State University, Marshall Kapp, director of the FSU University Center for Innovative Collaboration in Medicine and Law. Talk about combining two hot topics, huh? Faculty member in the College of Medicine and College of Law, too, and a member of the American Medical Directors Association Foundation Scientific Council. What a mouthful, huh? Also, the editor of the American College of Legal Medicine's Journal of Legal Medicine, serves on the editorial boards of several other major journals in the health law field, and he actually sleeps 2 or 3 hours a day, from what I understand. Marshall, good to have you.
Good morning.
Well, let's start off with the first, Kathy, if you could give us a little overview for the maybe 2 or 3 people listening who do not know what Big Bend Hospice is. What exactly is the organization?
Big Bend Hospice is a community-based hospice. It's been in Tallahassee 29 years, and we're going to celebrate our 30th anniversary next year. And we are located on Mayan Center Boulevard, but we service the 8-county area around Big Bend.
Okay. And Reverend McKibben, you've got kind of some heavy lifting when it comes to those aforementioned emotional and psychological ramifications of death and dying and bereavement and grief management and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. In our work, we are able to work with people at a very vulnerable time in their lives, but also a very sacred time where they are evaluating what matters most to them. And so we have that privilege of working in that capacity and with families during the transition and afterwards so that we are able to help them as they travel the journey of grief.
Yeah, you talk about that journey, and I want to expand on that in just a little bit. Well, Professor Kapp, again, welcome to Perspectives. Combining law and medicine. You go down to the Capitol, and those two arenas are usually at each other's throats. How do you put them all together?
Well, that's the challenge. I have to hear bad jokes about both professions. But I arrived at Florida State about 2 years ago, the medical school and the law school, through some really progressive thinking on the part of the two deans. Decided that we needed to do something that would involve collaboration or at least communications between the healthcare professions and the legal profession in a way that would benefit the consumer, that would benefit the person who's both the doctor's patient and the lawyer's client. And what we're going to be talking about this morning is an example of that kind of project that involves both medical expertise, other healthcare expertise, legal expertise, and ultimately will result in benefit for consumers and their families.
Well, we have all been exposed to at least one absolutely horrific example of whether it was a breakdown in communication or a misinterpretation or whatever the heck happened several years ago with that Terri Schiavo thing where the whole family got involved and it became a political football and just a media free-for-all on that just over the fact that no one seemed to know what this young woman really wanted during her final time here on Earth. And what was your take on that, Kathy? What did you think of that?
Well,
mess?
I was appalled that her family had to go through such a difficult situation and that family members were actually against one another's wishes. And I think it ultimately ended up in court, and which, you know, does go back to the conversation we're having today and having advanced directives clearly written out and also discussed with your family and your healthcare provider. And unfortunately, Ms. Schiavo did not have that. And I believe her parents were devout Catholics, and her husband felt like that it was time to stop all of the aggressive care that she was receiving.
Well, the nuts and bolts of advanced directive we'll talk about momentarily, but Reverend Candace, how do you get folks in the mood to even think about that kind of stuff? Because we don't want to. That's an admission that, you know, this is going to end. And if we deal with it, maybe it'll even speed it up. I don't know. Is that why we don't want to go there?
I think it is such a deeply emotional thing that it is hard for people to talk about it. But if we talk about it before we are involved in a situation where someone is close to death or in a critical situation, the conversation can be so much easier. And so finding ways to entertain this topic while you're healthy and well, so that you can express what you wish little by little over time, instead of it being one sit-down meeting where we're going to get this hammered out and we're going to write it down on a piece of paper. We bring it up along the way so that we can have meaningful conversation about what matters to us. It's the kind of conversation that brings families closer together, that's an intimate conversation that isn't just about whether I want a feeding tube or not. It's what I value in life, what makes my life worth living, what are the important things to me that I want people to know about as I depart, make the final exit. So the conversation can be so much richer than just getting something down on a piece of paper.
No, so you don't do this solo in a closet somewhere and then come out with it and say, okay, here's what I want you guys to do.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Professor, you've done a lot of research on this thing. POLST, POLST, that was a term that I heard thrown around. What's that all about?
Right. Well, POLST stands for Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And that's really the next generation of advanced directives. I know we're going to talk about advanced directives as statements that document the patient's wishes regarding future medical care. And it's not just about dying. It's about how you want to live at the end of your life on the way to your final illness. But the advanced directive is a statement by the individual. The POLST is the next generation. The POLST takes the discussion, the communication that has revolved around the advance directive and builds on that in a way that formalizes it into a written order by the physician regarding the kinds of treatment that an individual would or would not receive when they become critically ill. So it translates the patient's wishes, which are expressed in the advance directive, into a physician's order. And the advantage of that is that healthcare providers are used to following doctor's orders, to honoring and implementing doctor's orders, whereas they are not used to honoring and implementing the patient's expressed wishes. And that's why we think that the Pulse represents an advance. We're all for advanced directives. We're all for the communication that's entailed with advanced directives. We're all for the documentation that advanced directives provide that are very helpful in many situations. But we'd like to take that one step further. And there are a number of states that have implemented the Pulse idea. We're trying to encourage its use and its recognition here in Florida. And the center that I direct at Florida State has taken on the leadership role in coordinating the statewide efforts in that regard.
Okay. So it almost sounds like you're saying that in many instances, physicians can't read plain English, and you have to put it in something that they can comprehend or that they will recognize as having more authority than just a simple statement, this is what I want.
Well, I wouldn't put it in pejorative terms that the physician can't read plain English. But advanced directives sometimes can be written, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this, in a way that's ambiguous, that requires interpretation. And also, it just there is, for better or worse, there is a lot of research that shows that physicians are – not just physicians, but other healthcare providers, the EMTs, for example, who are called to your house when your family panics because you've had a cardiac arrest. Healthcare professionals are more likely to honor and implement a physician's order than a patient's expression of wishes. That may be good or bad. That may say something good or bad about healthcare professionals. But the reality is that if our goal is to make sure that people who are critically ill receive the kinds of care that they want in the final stages of their life, the Pulse really does, the physician's order really does seem to represent an advantage over the traditional advanced directive.
Sounds a little bit like a prescription you keep in your hip pocket.
Exactly. It's a doctor's order.
We'll talk more about the Pulse, but I also want to find out exactly how you go about with preparing an advanced directive from the get-go. And, Kathy, we'll get into that here right after we take a little time out here on Perspectives. 414-1234 is the number in the Tallahassee area. Long distance, it's 800-926-8809. And Perspectives at WFSU.org is the email. We'll be right back. What do we do before the final curtain falls? Think of all the euphemisms for death. You know, we could have a lot of fun with that today. But it's something we all have to deal with at some point or another. And particularly if you want to make sure that your wishes, what you would like to have happen before that final curtain falls actually occurs, that's what we're here talking about today on Perspectives. We have two folks from Big Bend Hospice. We also have a Florida State University professor who can talk about the intersection of medicine and the law when it comes to those sorts of things. So let's start off with Kathy Atkinson here from Big Bend Hospice. An advanced directive, what exactly is it and how do you put one together?
Well, an advanced directive basically allows you to choose your healthcare choices in advance, particularly for what you want done and what you don't want done as a disease progresses. And there's two different types of advanced directives. We have a healthcare power of attorney, which typically an attorney does have to draw up, and we also have a living will. So, you know, those two things are extremely important. My husband and I just had all of this done about a month ago, and we've been talking about this for quite some time, and it was kind of remarkable because he said, well, you don't want that done? Well, I want everything done. I'm like, no, honey, you don't want everything done. Let me explain why you don't want. And you know, and having been around me all these years, even he was a little bit troubled by what having to make some of those really difficult decisions So it's a conversation, as Reverend Candace was just discussing, that it's not, you know, a 1 hour at the dinner table. It's a long-term conversation with your family, your loved ones, even with your physician on what you want and desire. In the state of Florida, as Marshall, Professor Kapp was just mentioning, we don't have throughout our healthcare system where there is a particular pulsed, or even in Wisconsin, there's respecting choices. So it is problematic with the different healthcare entities. They all have a different form, and so on. So it can be a very complicated process, and you have to communicate with your physician and your family.
Because 22 years ago, before my mom died, there was a very simple piece of paper she filled out, and I think the expression was no extraordinary measures.
Yes.
And that was sufficient. And well, you're saying that's not
sufficient. Well, you know, we do have in Florida a do not resuscitate order, which means that you do not want to have cardiopulmonary resuscitation. Many states have allow natural death, which I'm pretty sure, and I have to ask Professor Kapp if that's true in Florida, but we don't have that as something that we can write and our physicians can write, is to allow natural death. And that is significantly different than a do not resuscitate order.
This is more involved than I thought it was. What actually legally in Florida, Marshall, what's the deal?
Well, we have a number of statutes that are relevant in Florida. We have Florida Statute Chapter 765, which creates the mechanism that allows an individual, a competent adult individual, to execute the kinds of advanced directives that Kathy was talking about. We also have a separate durable power of attorney statute that allows us to name an agent to be our decision maker in the future if we're not able to make our own decisions. We also have Chapter 401 of the Florida statutes, which is the do not resuscitate order statute that empowers the Department of Health to create a form. It's called a yellow form because it's on yellow paper. That is a doctor's order. Do not resuscitate is a doctor's order that instructs others not to attempt to resuscitate, do cardiopulmonary resuscitation on an individual. But that form only pertains to resuscitation. It doesn't have anything to do with all the other kinds of medical interventions that might be attempted on an individual. The pulse, the physician's order that we were talking about, we do not have any specific statute or regulation that authorizes it. By the same token, I would argue, my interpretation is that there is nothing in existing law in Chapter 765 or Chapter 401 that would prohibit a doctor from writing a pulse for a patient, and that would prohibit other healthcare providers from obeying that. But the problem is a lot of physicians are very reluctant to go the next step to write the pulse order. A lot of health professionals are reluctant to honor the pulse without some official governmental stamp of approval or imprimatur. So that's one of the things that our center is doing, working with a large network of over 100 individuals and organizations throughout the state of Florida to strategize how to go about it, whether we need legislation, whether we need regulation, whether we need professional education. Certainly we need professional and public education, how to go about accomplishing the acceptance of the pulsed idea and then its implementation here in Florida. But you know, the bottom line is, as I would interpret it, there's nothing in existing law that stands in the way of pulsed, but there's also nothing I can point to tangibly that explicitly authorizes it.
Okay, so you could even go through all this rigmarole, have it all written down, very nicely codified and ready to go, and yet there's no guarantee that it would even be followed?
That is the problem.
Yes.
That is the problem. And in fact, in Florida, as in I believe every other state, there's an explicit statutory provision that says that if a physician, as a matter of his or her own conscience, chooses not to follow the patient's expressed wishes, there's no legal liability. There's no criminal, civil, or professional liability. We respect the physician's right of conscience, which I think is a good thing. But what that does mean is exactly what you were saying. There's no assurance that even if a patient has done all the right things, his or her wishes are going to get followed at the end of life.
Reverend McKibben, it sounds like we're back in Terry Schiavoville.
Well, and I think that's why this discussion today is so critical, and ongoing discussions among the people, the collaboration that Marshall's working on and that Big Bend Hospice is hoping to work together with them and others on, about getting understanding so that we have some uniformity and there is a way to enforce people's wishes once we have a system that honors that.
Well, if we're, as individuals, kind of reluctant to get into this whole thing anyway because of, you know, the whole mortality thing, and we don't have any real statutory authority back behind it, where do we go from here? What do we do?
I would have to say, this is Kathy Atkinson, I would have to say that families have to have a united front. And it's been my experience in hospitals. I'm a registered nurse, and it's been my experience that a hospital system, if you have it, A, in writing, or B, you have the children of a family member, and they say, no, we don't want our mother put on a ventilator, they will listen to you. And so it does require excellent communication. It's kind of funny because the federal government did the Patient Self-Determination Act, and I can't remember what year that was. And so anybody that participates in Medicare, which would be both of our local hospitals, majority of our physicians, and so on, we're required to present information on advance directives to every single patient. So, but it's such a system now that you say, yes, I have one, I don't have one. Nobody discusses it with you. You know, you're not telling your healthcare provider what you actually want. And it was interesting when we just drew up our advance directives, our lawyer here locally said, who is your physician? And so they sent it to them, and in turn they have to sign it and say they received it and understand it, and which I had never seen that done before, which I thought that was pretty neat. And so I thought, well, okay, our family practice physician now knows what we want to do and what our wishes are, which, don't get me wrong, they have a lot of patients that is still our responsibility when we, you know, have a crisis or whatever, and when we go in the hospital, that we clearly state what our wishes are. But the communication has started, and that's what's important, is starting the communication. You know, the thing about advanced directives, and Professor Kapp, tell me if I'm wrong, you can still change your mind. So if for example, my husband is my power of attorney, and healthcare surrogate, and I'm incapacitated, he can say, hold on, I do want everything done. Hopefully he would not do that, because we have communicated pretty clearly about that, and I will come back and haunt him if he does not do what I want. But, you know, so that is sort of the beauty of the system, and it's also its biggest problem, because you can change your mind at any moment in time. So how do you communicate that throughout the healthcare system? That's, to me, is a real issue. And the other issue is, I'm going to go into a little bit in the weeds here, all of the healthcare systems in the U.S. All have different electronic medical records. So when you have that, you may have it at my doctor's office, but if I go into TMH or CRMC, they may not have it. It may be in an emergency. My husband can't find it. You know, all those things happen. And I do happen to know in Wisconsin that the whole there is a statewide system, and it is on the electronic medical record throughout the state. And we do not have that in the state of Florida. And when you look at the elderly population that we have, we have some, I think, some real obstacles, and Marshall and his folks and others are working on that. But it's kind of remarkable when you look at that we are the leaders in so many things in the state of Florida, but something so significant in healthcare where we haven't been.
Well, even something as pedestrian as going to get a tank of gas and you swipe your debit card at the pump and immediately it knows who you are, what your balance is, all the other information, and will authorize or decline the opportunity to give you gasoline. And that works anywhere in the country. And yet our, as you pointed out, Kathy, our medical records, which I would submit might be a little bit more critical, are in different formats in different places and
precisely,
are accessible here but not accessible there, and we can't get any uniformity.
Well, you know, the recent healthcare bill that is very controversial, and I won't go into that anymore more than to say that there is a requirement in there, if I'm not mistaken, by, I don't know, 2015, 2018, that all of the medical profession in the U.S. basically has to have electronic medical record. And so we have physicians that are scrambling trying to make sure, because they're going to reduce their reimbursement, their Medicare reimbursement, and I think potentially their Medicaid reimbursement if they are not able to do this. Very expensive. Typical physician's office, I heard, is about $50,000 to have an electronic medical record. And I know how much it has cost Big Bend Hospice over the years, extremely expensive. But none of them talk to each other. They don't interface. Canada's been trying to do this for, I don't know, 15 years, and they still, and they, you know, have more of a socialized medicine, and they still have not achieved that goal. So I think we have a long way to go in the U.S.
Okay, and Marshall, does Pulse either address this issue or depend on it being resolved?
Well, the portability of the Pulse instrument, just like the portability of an advanced directive, is a key issue because we're a mobile society. I may do all the right things in terms of discussing and documenting my future treatment wishes. That may be communicated with my personal physician who understands me and my values and my preferences very well. But I end up having my health crisis when I'm visiting 1,000 miles away or traveling. I get a lot of calls from both physicians and attorneys in other states who have clients or patients who spend part of their time in Florida, and they want to inquire about the availability of Pulse here and the portability. And so there's the issue of even if the paperwork, whether it's on paper or electrons, is in place, the person who's actually treating you when you have a health crisis near the end of life, maybe somebody who's never met you before, who doesn't know your values and your wishes and hasn't been privy to the prior discussion. So, yes, how we achieve that portability is very, very important. Now, again, I think that's an advantage of Pulse in that a properly written Pulse form, and we don't have an official Pulse form in Florida, but we do have some models that are now being piloted in various programs around the state. And those pilot programs are described, and their models are posted on our center website, actually. The likelihood that the physician is going to understand and obey and honor the Pulse form, even if it's written by someone in a different geographic area, someone on a different hospital staff, someone who that physician or other healthcare professional doesn't know, I think is much higher, the likelihood of that being honored and implemented, than a standard advanced directive. Now, another aspect is that in several states, particularly Oregon, which is the leader in the Pulse movement, they have created an electronic registry where Pulse signed by physicians are stored. And there's a system whereby when the EMT comes to your house because your family has called them, the EMT can access the registry and determine whether, in fact, you have a valid pulse that's been executed and can treat you according to that. So ideally, we would, in this state, have pulsed accepted broadly as an idea, have it implemented, and then create some sort of registry that could be accessed because these decisions about whether to resuscitate somebody, whether to intubate somebody, whether to give somebody antibiotics all occur in a crisis mode. These are choices that have to be made very, very quickly when there's not a lot of time for contemplation. So we need a system that accounts for the crisis nature of decision making.
Well, I think we have here. We can get this in before the break if we can. Jessica here in Tallahassee has a question that just locks right into this. Hi, Jessica. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Good morning. I just turned on the program and was listening to your speakers. Why couldn't that be a part of the form when you have a insurance card, like the Medicare card or your Blue Cross Blue Shield card? It could be right on there. I mean, it's just a very brief, you know, do not resuscitate, DNR, or, you know, something of that nature.
Or even I'm thinking we have on our driver licenses that we are organ donors, and that's supposed to also be kind of taken into account if, you know, we wipe out on the highway and no one knows who we are. At least, hey, you know, try to keep these piece parts alive as much as we possibly can. Headed towards a break right now, and we'll talk about the need for cards or some other way of letting physicians and others know what our advanced wishes might be in the case of impending demise here on Perspectives with our expert panel. 414-1234-800-926-8809. We'll be back in a moment. Okay, how can you tell before the final checkout, if you will? All these euphemisms were tapped in. Before you die, hate to be so direct, but before that happens, how can we make sure that our doctors, our family members, everyone else involved in the process beyond ourselves kind of knows what we'd like to have happen? That's what we're talking about here on Perspectives with Kathy Akison and Reverend Candace McKibben from Big Bend Hospice and Professor Marshall Kapp from the Innovative Collaboration Center for Medicine and Law at Florida State University. Jessica had just asked about, is there some kind of card we can carry around to let folks know, in case we cannot speak for ourselves, that we do have some final wishes and how to access those?
Well, it's not a bad idea. I mean, certainly one could put on a card, I have a pulsed or I have an advanced directive. I don't think it would be practical to put the document itself on the card, but a notice that I do have such a document so that healthcare professionals know to look for it. The problem is, as I was saying before, these decisions about whether to resuscitate, whether to intubate, whether to give drugs on the spot, those decisions need to be made in a crisis situation, and there often is not time to search the patient's wallet. Remember, you're ordinarily talking at that point about a patient who's not capable of speaking for himself or herself physically. So it may not be practical to expect that EMT on the spot who has to make a split-second decision about whether to initiate resuscitation, for example, is going to check the individual's wallet. And then if the wallet contains a card saying I have a pulse, to then investigate further. That's the problem, is the practicality. But it's a good idea. I mean, we hear situations of people that have DNR orders tattooed on their forehead.
Yeah, do not resuscitate. Yeah, But it still kind of begs the question as to how you can communicate this information not only to, again, other family members and people who might be involved from that end, but also the entire medical community. And split-second decisions, it just might not work.
Well, they might not work, but the more you do to document and to discuss, particularly with your family, because as Kathy was saying earlier, if the family presents a united front, it is much more likely that their wishes and the patient's wishes will get followed than if there is apparent disagreement among the family at the time the decision needs to be made. That guarantees chaos.
Yeah, and we need to talk about that in just a moment. First, let's get to Michael here. Speaking of wishes, I think he has five of them. Hi, Michael. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I was listening to your show, and I'm a financial planner here in town. And several years ago, it was brought to my attention a document that sounds kind of like what you're talking about. It's called Five Wishes, and I believe it's a type of living will in it. I am so sold on it that I make it available at no charge to any and all of my clients who would like to have one. And it goes much, although it does cover in detail everything in a legal fashion, it talks about personal, emotional needs such as that, as well as medical wishes, which goes beyond the important but boring legal information, which also is included in there. And I think this is something that was started right here in Tallahassee. And it's just, and oh, by the way, I ran and grabbed one just now. I'm looking at it. On the last page, there's something they call a Five Wishes wallet card, which does exactly what you were talking about a moment ago, telling them if they did find it in the wallet, that they have this advance directive, and here's my agent, here's my primary care physician, and so on and so forth. I was wondering, what those folks think about the five wishes.
Well, let's find out. Thank you so much for your call, Michael. Kathy, what'd you think?
I'm glad Michael called in because we have a great partnership with the local Aging with Dignity, which started Five Wishes in 1997 in Tallahassee, Florida. They're remarkable, and we do a lot of collaborative work with them. We were recently at the Governor Square Mall on Saturday handing out Five Wishes and telling the public we would be more than happy to come speak to them about advanced directives and such. And if you want to contact Big Ben Hospice, we're at 878-5310, or you can send us a message on bigbenhospice.org. We will speak to any individual, the community, churches, your civic group, whoever you want to, about Five Wishes and advanced directives. But they're a great group, and I actually have a Five Wishes in front of me too, Michael. So it's very well known in this area. Unfortunately, I'm afraid a lot of people don't ever complete their Five Wishes or talk to their family about it.
Well, before we talk to the family, there had been some, I guess, debate about whether or not emergency responders would check a wallet for a card or something like that.
Yes.
Maybe we should have like a metal necklace like dog tags, mm-hmm. or perhaps even a tattoo.
I've heard of patients that, you know, how you wear the bracelet for being a diabetic or whatever, that are now getting a do not resuscitate bracelet. So you can actually purchase those online. So there is availability for that. But, you know, with a crisis situation, most people are going to want to be resuscitated. If you're in a major pileup on I-10, you're going to want to be resuscitated, whether you have stage 4 cancer with metastasis. It's, you know, getting to the hospital after that, after you're stabilized, and what happens to you. That probably is really the main question that needs to be answered.
Yeah, most folks probably don't want to just die out on the highway.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And I think really with advanced directives, we're really talking about a family member that has stage for cancer with metastasis, and it's spread all over the body. And we recently got a referral on a patient last week that was relatively young, 45 years old, no family here. I believe her brother was somewhere out of state and ended up on a ventilator at one of the local hospitals. We got involved, and but she ended up being on the ventilator for, I think it was almost 2 weeks. And she was given antibiotics. And here is a terminal woman. You know, her condition is terminal, and all of these measures were done, expensive measures. And, you know, her brother was extremely torn because of her age and that they had not talked about what her wishes were.
Okay, Reverend McKibben, let's talk about that little family conversation. Hopefully while everyone is conversant and healthy and bright and all that sort of thing, mm-hmm. how do you reach some kind of consensus? Because you always have what we were talking before we went on the air. The daughter from Jersey who will say, no, we must keep mom or dad alive at any and all costs, no matter how bad things are. Meanwhile, mom and dad's going, no, for crying out loud, I don't want to be a burden on you guys or anything else. And how do you bring the family together and everyone agrees, okay, here's what we're going to do?
I think in some communities, there are people that are skilled at that conversation who help families and who would take very seriously the daughter that said, no, we got to do everything for mom, and would explore with her, well, can you tell me a little bit more about what everything means to you? And if everything meant that ribs would be broken, that there would be a very slight percent of people who actually are able to regain the ability that they had before they were resuscitated, or that the fluid was too much for their body to absorb if it's about a feeding tube or IV fluids. You know, they were able to explore some of these issues where for people who say we want everything, to say this is what it really means if that is what you're wanting. And to explore if your mother or father don't want to suffer in that way and have said that, then, you know, explain a little more about why you would want to go against that wish. So there are people that can help in communities having those discussions. I think when I did this with my own family, when we sat down around the table in Jacksonville, Florida, I was very apprehensive about this and felt like it was going to be a very difficult conversation. And what it ended up being was a lovely time to reminisce about our life together as a family. I don't think we'd all five sat at that dining room table in years. And we talked about childhood experiences, and we talked about vacations, and all kinds of things came out that I had not anticipated at all. But we were able to finally settle on what we thought would be most appropriate and honoring of our parents and their wishes. My father said, I don't want to go to a nursing home. I don't want to be put in that kind of situation. My mother said, do whatever is best for you, children. That's what I want. And my daddy said, I'll miss you. So we had a good laugh about that.
It sounds like a great family reunion.
Well, it was. It really was. I think it's just the idea of continuing to explore and to not be put off by any question that comes up, but to try to get at what does that mean? Say more about what that means. And having a discussion versus feeling like you have to get everything settled, you know, right then and there. And so ongoing discussions and continuing that discussion. We all know that life ends in death, and that's the progression that happens. So it shouldn't come as a surprise to any of us. But getting these concepts worked out and exploring these kinds of things is such a tremendous gift to the family. It is an amazing gift to the family when they can stand together and represent what they know this person wants. And while the system is all messed up and we've got a lot of work to do, you're one step closer to having your wishes honored if you've articulated them in a way that can be upheld.
And that's the whole purpose. Let's go back to the phones. Eunice is on line 2 here in Tallahassee. Hi, Eunice.
good morning.
Morning.
I'm interested in knowing if one should perhaps take the do not recessive the orders with one in one's wallet or that kind of thing, because if I were in some place far away, then that would be there, and that would depend on the state, I suppose, and how they deal with that. The other one, the question that I wanted to ask is, I don't like to take a lot of the tests that doctors prescribe. I would prefer to just, you know, let things take their course. I was wondering about signing a legal paper so that the doctor, I would not hold the doctor accountable and pass that on to my children. Have you had that kind of experience?
Kind of a hold harmless type thing. Marshall, what do you think?
Well, I'm not sure if this is exactly what you mean, but certainly we have the legal and ethical doctrine of informed consent. If you're a competent adult person, nobody can do anything to you in terms of tests or procedures or other kinds of medical interventions without your permission. And so you can refuse, just as you have the right to give informed consent to medical interventions that your healthcare providers recommend. You have the right to refuse those medical interventions as well. And it should be an informed refusal. The physician should explain to you why he or she is recommending what he or she is recommending. But if you make an informed choice to forego any medical intervention, you have the right to do that.
Mm-hmm. And if, as Eunice said, if there you have some kind of a not only do not resuscitate but just do not medically intervene type of card, is that even enforceable in other states if you're, you know, in Georgia or California or somewhere?
Well, I think the problem is less enforceability, legal enforceability, than will it be interpreted? Is there ambiguity? Can it be interpreted? What does that mean, no medical intervention? You used the term earlier, extraordinary, no extraordinary care. What does that mean? In some circumstances, that feeding tube might be extraordinary because it won't lead to recovery. But in other cases where it's a short-term thing, where it might lead to recovery, it's not extraordinary. So we have this language problem, this interpretation problem. It's good to have the documents with you, yes. That's the idea. You don't want to execute these documents and have them be a secret. That doesn't help any. You don't want to lock it in your safety deposit box. That does no good. You don't want it to be a secret. You want to share copies with others for whom that would be important. But it's important that that the other forms of communication have also taken place and that your wishes are expressed as unambiguously as possible.
And in the case of medical and emergency personnel, a pulsed or a physician's worded type of document may carry more weight than just a simple advance directive.
There is evidence to that effect.
I wanted to make a comment. This is Kathy Atkinson, that when I wrote we had our advance directives written recently, we had in there we did not want any futile health care measures done. And when you add that language, that is different than not having it. For example, that have a feeding tube put in and you are legally brain dead would be a futile measure. There's no improvement in your condition ever. So I would encourage the listeners to make sure that they include that language. And I don't know legally how that is, but that's certainly Marshall's expertise. But I do know in things that I have researched on advanced directives, so the futility of treatment is really where a lot of people don't want to have all of the health care of a feeding tube, to have a to be resuscitated, all those kind of things. They don't want it done if it's going to be a futile measure.
Mm-hmm. Although I can almost hear some physicians buzzing my ear right now saying, we don't know it's futile until we try it.
Yes. Yes.
We only have a few moments left to go. Reverend Candace McKibben, any final thoughts from you on this?
I'm thinking of the many wonderful physicians that I serve with on ethics committees at the hospital and at Big Bend Hospice, and how important this conversation is to them. I think they want to do the right thing for patients at the end of life, and so having this kind of document for them, I think, is critical.
Thanks so much. We appreciate it. Marshall Kapp, thank you so much for coming on, too, and Kathy Atkinson, also from Big Bend Hospice. We appreciate you coming on Perspectives Today, which is produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Taylor Cox on the board, Michael Fleming on the phones and emails. I'm Tom Flanagan. We're going to step aside next week for the Spring Pledge Drive. We'll be back with a local writers' roundtable on May 5th. Hope you can join us then here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.